This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the status of the landmark Goldstone report 2 years after its issuance.
Our lens for looking at that report will be this remarkable new book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. This important book unravels the Israeli-United States narrative that somehow the attack on Gaza was justified and that it was done within the law. Read this book and you will know that both of those are lies. In an extraordinarily interesting interview, we'll talk to the three co-editors, Adam Horwitz, Lizzie Ratner, and Philip Weiss, and we'll talk about the dozen or so essays, including those by Desmond Tutu and Naomi Klein, on what Gaza meant then and what it means today.
Stay with us.
Heidi, I understand you've just come back from visiting a prison in Pennsylvania, where you were having a visit with Mamia Abu-Jamal. Can you tell us what that prison is like, how Mamia is doing, what your impressions were?
Yes, I went to SCI Green, which is in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. I met with Mumia and also with three other inmates, two of whom have been in solitary confinement for many years.
Is this death row people?
Well, it's a combination of death row and others.
Is Mumia technically on death row?
He's technically on death row. So I met with a 67-year-old Russell Maroon Schoetz. And people listening may know about him because recently he was up, as he goes up before the program review board, on a motion to move from solitary confinement to the general population. And he told me that the Ninth Circuit in 1982, in his case Schoetz v. Horn, wrote, "They'll never let him out of solitary." And that's clearly for political reasons. He was a former Black Panther Party person, but also he escaped twice. And as he told me yesterday, he feels that the current warden doesn't want to take responsibility for a possible third escape.
How many
at
years
67 years
in?
Old.
And how many
he's
years has
been in 21 years in solitary confinement.
In solitary?
And he hasn't committed an infraction during that time. The Program Review Board met on January 5th, and it seems that they're denying the efforts to move him back into general. But people should know that SCI Green is a facility where specialist Charles Grainer of Abu Ghraib fame was actually a prison guard. He had been in the Marines from 88 to 96. And in 1998, prisoners at SCI Green complained of routine beatings and humiliation, including a sadistic game called Simon Says, in which guards struck prisoners who failed to comply with their barked instructions. And that was covered by the New York Times.
And eventually they got rid of him out of that prison, right?
They did. They
this is Sergeant Grainer. And then he graduated to heading one of the key people in the interrogation at Abu Ghraib,
yeah,
and got a very long, the only one who got a severe sentence really out of that,
right.
Relatively severe.
Exactly.
Sentence.
And one might say that he got some of his preparation at SCI Green.
Right. So that's what we do. When they're too brutal, even for our prisons here, we send them overseas. And he was, as you recall, as people may recall, he's the one who had the relationship with Lindy England.
Exactly. I'd like to also mention that in 1988, a couple of dozen inmates at SCI Green who were in the hole, or the restricted housing unit, where a lot of the abuse happened, went on a hunger strike over prison authorities confiscating their legal papers. So what was happening, I guess their mail was being intercepted. And that hunger strike brought attention to the widespread brutalization of inmates there. One of the things that guards did was beat the prisoners and then, with inmates' blood, write KKK.
So this is a bad place.
It's a bad place.
Now tell us, bring us up to date a bit on Mamia.
Yes. Well, Mamia.
You've seen me at Mamia before, is that correct?
Yeah, I'd seen him a couple of months ago, and he was in excellent spirits. As usual, talks a lot about literature, the state of current affairs. I wanted to mention a book that he really liked that he just finished called Griftopia by Mike Taibbi, who you know is a reporter, sort of an investigative journalist. And in the book, Taibbi talks about Wall Street, blames the financial people for frauds perpetrated over the last decade. And
is that the name of the book again?
It's called Griftopia. It's a great title. And he apparently says that the collusion between Wall Streeters and the White House has essentially turned the U.S. into a massive casino in which most working Americans are bilked out of their savings and homes while the wealthy are rewarded. So he liked that. Now, I also asked, I told Mumia about Law and Disorder. He asked about it. He knew we had the show. And he asked what the themes were. And I said, the emerging police state. And he said, William Kunstler has a book by that name. And he just sent me a little thing that he said. The emerging police state was on my pile of books. They're all allowed 10 books at a time. It blew me away. It's a collection of Kunstler's speeches. They are remarkable for what they say. His speech to a group of defense attorneys was essentially saying that we're all taught from law school that we are officers of the court. We respond to that and we act like that. But shouldn't we really be officers of our clients? And Mumia said, that has always struck with me. Everyone should read it. We are still in the secret age of Guantanamo.
Now, weren't one of the editors of that book is to your right?
I think that Michael Smith is. And well, he loved the book.
It was not just me. It was two of Bill's daughters, Karen and Sarah. I'm so pleased that the book found its way into that crappy prison and into Mumia's hands.
Yeah. Where's Mumia's case right now?
The hope is that the Third Circuit, and it's a three-judge panel, the same three-judge panel that heard this case a little over 3 years ago, our hope is that they stay with their original decision. And that would mean likely Mumia will just stay life in prison.
Right. And if they don't stay with their original decision, but if they say, we made the wrong decision because of what the Supreme Court said, then what happens?
Then I think there are two options. One is that the state will set a new date for execution. The other is that the state will say, we want a new sentencing phase. Even though they can't consider, quote, new evidence, it would allow the facts to be brought before the public at large. But on the other hand, a lot of death penalty experts say, you don't want a new sentencing phase. We'll see. And the decision could come down any day now, or it could be a while, as we're used to waiting for decisions in this case.
Well, thank you very much. And, of course, Mumia has the solidarity of all of us at Law and Disorder.
Michael, you had a long involvement with Haiti and with President Aristide in particular. I remember when he was kidnapped by Navy SEALs and ripped out of his country and sent to South Africa, where he still is. But in the meantime, the horrific dictator, Papa Doc's son, Baby Doc, showed up a couple of days ago in Haiti and was arrested and then quickly let go. What's going on?
I mean, Haiti reminds me of 100 Years of Solitude, you know, the book by
Garcia Marquez,
in the sense that it seems like completely just repeat fantasies over and over again and doesn't seem to have a way out. And I was so profoundly shocked to see Baby Doc get off a plane in Port-au-Prince. This is a guy who was driven out of office, who was completely corrupt, who was involved in very serious human rights violations, from jailings to murders to torture. And in fact, they quoted in the paper recently a guy I used to know who was one of the star soccer players in Haiti who had been badly brutalized in prison, who said he couldn't believe that this is Baby Doc getting off the plane. And the first thing that comes to mind is, how did he ever do that? How did Air France or whoever let him on the plane let him on? And how did he get through immigration in Port-au-Prince? I just don't have an answer for it other than that the whole system is corrupt, or at least part of the whole system is corrupt. And then you reflect on that and reflect on what would have happened if President Aristide had boarded a plane from South Africa to get back into Port-au-Prince. Do you think anyone in Haiti would have let him back in? I mean, we don't know the answer to that, but I think it's very unlikely. And, of course, the differences are profound. President Aristide would go back as the popular leader of the entire nation and would sweep away any opposition and would become the next president of Haiti. Would be really the only way out of the impasse that I currently see right now, President Aristide returning. And instead, what do you get? you get Baby Doc going back. Then I guess after a couple of days, the Haitian government was totally embarrassed and compromised, Michael, as you said. And then Amnesty International, all the groups said, how could this be? And then they had a what looks like a staged arrest at one of the fancy hotels. He walks out, he goes before a court, and he gets bail, and he supposedly can't leave Haiti. Well, we'll see. It's hard to believe this wasn't worked out pretty carefully before.
Yeah.
Why would a guy go back like that?
Yeah.
It's just an astoundingly bad turn of events when the real president of Haiti is sitting in exile in South Africa. The U.S. not only wouldn't allow him back into Haiti, when there were suggestions that he might want to live in Jamaica or nearby or even in Venezuela, the U.S. completely forbid him from coming back into
this part
of the
hemisphere. Well, that's not because the U.S. is driven by good motives. They had hoped through Baby Doc to set up a colony in Haiti where they could get cheap labor. And all the money they sent to Haiti to set up that kind of infrastructure was ripped off by Baby Doc. Some people estimate $1 billion.
So we'll see how this unfolds, but the chances of Baby Doc being jailed for any kind of lengthy basis seem about zero, although I would say the chances of President Aristide coming back have gone up since this has happened, because it's so unspeakable what has happened in Haiti with Baby Doc. Today we have a special hour on Gaza, the two-year aftermath. And we will look at Gaza through a new important book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. The authors, Lizzie Ratner, Adam Horwitz, and Phil Weiss, have reprinted the central findings of the report and include 11 extraordinary essays chronicling the report's ongoing impact. Foreword is written by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and the introduction is written by famed author Naomi Klein. As people will recall, the Goldstone Report was heavily criticized by Israel, by Jewish groups, by the U.S. Congress itself. This book takes on that criticism and takes it on in the form of sharply worded, concise essays explaining the key points that you need to understand if you want to comprehend why the United States and why Israel wanted to bury this report forever. Well, as you'll see from this interview, the Goldstone Report remains critical to our understanding of Israel and the United States' role in the Middle East. This important book unravels the Israeli-United States narrative that somehow the attack on Gaza was justified and that it was done within the law. Read this book, and you will know that both of those are lies. We're delighted to have with us today Lizzie Ratner, Adam Horwitz, and Philip Weiss. Lizzie, my niece, is a journalist here in New York City. Her articles have appeared in many publications, including The New York Times, The Nation, and Alternet. Adam is an editor and journalist covering American foreign policy in the Middle East. He co-edits the blog Mondo Weiss, and is a founding member of Jews Against the Occupation. Philip Weiss is a founder of the amazing, remarkable blog Mondo Weiss. He is a longtime journalist and regular contributor to The Nation. He is a fellow at The Nation Institute. He's also the author of two books, a political novel, Cock-a-Doodle-Doo, and American Taboo, an investigative account of a 1976 murder in the Peace Corps in the Kingdom of Tonga.
We're delighted to have with us today the editors of a new book titled The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. Welcome, Adam Horowitz, Lizzie Ratner, and Philip Weiss to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Lizzie, I'd like to start with you. Can you briefly summarize what you set out to do with this remarkable book and how you got the idea, essentially?
It's 2 years ago. It's exactly 2 years ago. On December 27th, Israel launched what they call Operation Cast Lead against Gaza, where they began bombing the captive population of Gaza. And for 22 days, they bombed the people of Gaza. They tightened the siege around Gaza. As many as 1,300 or more people in Gaza died. 13 Israelis died. And it was a moment of horror to kind of witness from a distance. And I remember sitting in my home at the time and watching events unfold and feeling powerless and feeling horrified and sick in my stomach as I saw this display of impunity, this display of incredibly disproportionate force against Gaza. And wondering at the time, this is happening, it's playing out in front of the whole world. Are people going to respond? Can this just happen? Is there some kind of law that says this can't happen? Is there popular will that just rises up and says this can't happen? What happens? And so then it was about 8 or 9 months later, in September of 2009, Richard Goldstone had been tapped to head the United Nations fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict. And he and the mission issued their report, September 2009. And the report comes out and says that Israel, as well as Hamas, committed war crimes in the Gaza during the Gaza conflict, possible war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. And it laid out a bunch of methods for requiring accountability on the part of the actors. And it basically said this kind of thing, this kind of disproportionate use of force, this targeting of civilians, it can't happen. And it was this incredibly powerful, effective document. What happened immediately when he basically said these incredibly powerful things was that all the forces lined up against him and said, this report is terrible and Richard Goldstone is a traitor and a self-hater. Richard Goldstone is Jewish. And immediately everybody, and I guess by everybody I mean sort of people in the Israeli establishment, Zionist establishment, and the United States as well, said, we've got to bury this report because it's too dangerous. It says that powers cannot simply go in to a country and shoot willy-nilly and bomb people indiscriminately.
And listeners should know that Judge Goldstone had 3 decades of really, I think, fair decision-making, was revered by many, and that the report was the result of interviewing many, many different individuals, often flying them out of the country to do so.
One aspect of this book that's critical, and I think you can mention that, Lizzie, is that part of the testimony that Goldstone took is actually in the book, testimony from people who were subjected to the bombings in Gaza, and it's quite compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's actually talk for just one moment about Goldstone and his history. Goldstone's South African. He was a member of the Constitutional Court in South Africa. After apartheid ended, he was appointed to head up an investigation into the apartheid police forces, which was an incredibly important investigation, which really pointed out the incredibly bigoted, racist, violent methods that they used. And he was quite acclaimed in South Africa as a fair and progressive jurist. His work in South Africa sort of catapulted him to the position of first prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. And he was incredibly respected for this work he did. Is seen as somebody who really helped advance international law, who helped, after decades of quiescence, to bring it back to the forefront and to say there's this great tool out there, international law, which allows us to go after perpetrators and to bring accountability for heinous crimes. And he's a big Zionist, and he's a committed Zionist. And in Israel, they loved him before this report. He was on the board of trustees of Hebrew University. I mean, you don't get to that position by being a schlump or by being somebody who's disrespected in Israel and sort of among the Israeli establishment. You know, he was fast friends with the head of the Supreme Court in Israel, Aaron Barak. And so he's a man who has respect, who's known as being sober, considered, who doesn't act rashly, and if anything, might have a vested interest in finding Israel hadn't committed any crimes, in sort of exculpating Israel. And so what happens is he goes to Gaza. He embarks on this mission in the spring of 2009. And actually, it's interesting. He says at one point after the fact that before he went to Gaza, he was nervous to go there. And he had fantasies or nightmares that he'd be kidnapped by Hamas. And I think my guess here is what happened is he went and he saw what life is like in Gaza and had a bit of a conversion and was pretty horrified by what he saw. So it's sort of this backstory which makes the report even more intriguing, I think, which makes us have to look at its contents a little bit more, because this is not somebody you would expect to come out and issue a report like this.
Give us some sense, Lizzie, of the structure of the book, because look at the report was issued 2 years ago. What you've done in the book is you've excerpted a good chunk of the report, but this book has a lot more in it.
Well, the book consists of 2 main components. It's a series of essays that surround a core, and that core is an abridged version of the report. So in deciding to do this book, our original mission was, there's this report out there. It is controversial. It's thunderous. It's convulsive. Everybody's talking about it. Not many people have read it. People will weigh in and say, oh, Goldstone did this or did that. But have they actually read the 452-page report? Unlikely. And so once we read it, and I have to give a hat tip here to Michael, because Michael was the one who read it first and said to us, you have to read this report. Once we read it, it became clear that its contents were extraordinary. It sort of lays out the events in Gaza in minute and devastating detail. It surrounds that with a whole analysis, a whole legal analysis of why the events in Gaza amount to violations of international human rights law and international law. So we wanted to get the report out there. It's very, very long. And so we decided to abridge the report. And that really forms the core of the book. But then it's a report that's been so talked about and so analyzed and so misunderstood that we felt like we needed to provide some analysis and understanding for the book. And so we have 13 different essays that surround the book. We have a wonderful introduction by Naomi Klein. Then the book sort of...
Well, the Naomi Klein thing, we should spend a second on that. I love her opening line, a sprawling crime scene. Not even a complete sentence in English. A sprawling crime scene. But when you read that, that's Naomi's visit to Gaza 6 months after Cass led. And it's just a completely, as Naomi does, a completely brilliant essay about what she saw when she was there for those 6 months. So after that, we have the report.
Right, then we have the report.
And then what happens next, Lizzie?
And then we have a series of 11 different essays.
Phil, what would be good to do is start going through these essays. There's 11 of them that come after the report. And let's talk about some of the points of each ones of those. First essay you have is The Right to Live in Dignity, which is by Raji Sarani. And you can tell us a little bit about how you chose them, who Raji is, and what some of the points are.
We had to contextualize the report in the sort of real world that it affected, and it's a living report. It's 2 years, a year and a half old, but it continues to have resonance. And the first and last essays are basically from Gazans about how it felt to be a Gazan during this. And Raji Sarani is a leading human rights figure in Gaza. He's done more to stand up for human rights in Palestine and Gaza than just about anybody. And he, in very vivid terms, explains what it felt like to be under assault, to see white phosphorus raining down on this strip, which is tiny. It's the size of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket put together, as I like to say, with 1.5 million people. That's kind of our lead essay.
Phil, I wanted to stay for a second on Raji's essay because there was two interesting points that were made in the book by Raji. One was, which you briefly alluded to, is that the policy that we saw in Gaza, or the killings, the type of war that was carried out, has been Israeli policy for decades. And it's a policy that's been approved by the Supreme Court. And it also goes on to talk about the Dahiya Doctrine.
Yes.
So if you can just mention that doctrine, what it is and what it represents, and then we'll go to the next essay.
Yes, the Dahiya Doctrine refers to a quarter of Beirut called Dahiya that Israel demolished in the 2006 war in Lebanon. And the philosophy behind Dahiya is that if a resistance movement or even terror organizations have perceived by Israel to have any roots in a civilian population, then that is a just rationale for sort of wiping out that civilian infrastructure at no matter the cost to human life. That is sort of a principle that Goldstone invokes again and again, which is lack of discrimination between civilians and combatants. And Israel has tried to ennoble that principle and say there is no distinction. And Goldstone has said, absolutely, there is a distinction. There are innocent people, and then there are combatants, and you have to take care under international law to discriminate.
Talk more, will you, about the Israeli narrative that what they did was of necessity, and it was done in self-defense. And I thought that your book brilliantly exposed that narrative in several of these essays. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, the Israeli narrative comes down to that icon that they came up with around the Gaza War, after the Gaza War, when they had come under such attack. And they tried to show a Hamas combatant firing from behind a baby carriage.
Yes.
They said, these people, these combatants are indistinguishable from the civilian population. This is the new way of war. These are non-state entities, and we need new tools to combat these combatants. What we showed in the essays that take on this analysis or claim is that how did Israel implement this new doctrine? Well, they implemented it by destroying the foodstuffs that support the civilian population of Gaza. They destroyed the sewage treatment facilities. They destroyed went after the water supply. They went after the largest flour producer, the only source of flour for Gazans. This was a theory that was, as Goldstone said, a deliberate attack on the civilian infrastructure, on the means of life. They went so far beyond any kind of, it's horrifying.
You did put in here an essay by a man named Halbertal, which was the essay that was the most critical of the Goldstone report.
Well, Michael, I'm glad that you raised that, because I thought that this was a key issue in the book and a brilliant move on your guys' part to put the Moshe Halbertal report in here. Halbertal says, and I'm going to quote one sentence from him, and this is what I'd like to talk about. He says, "The Goldstone report as a whole is a terrible document." Remember, this is written initially for the
New Republic.
"It is biased and unfair. It offers no help in sorting out the real issues." And then he lays out the real issue. "What methods can Israel and other countries in similar situations legitimately apply in the defense of their citizens?" That's the Israeli narrative. And your book was brilliant in explicating that. And I'd like to ask you to comment on Halbertal's position.
Thank you. I think it was great that we included that piece. I think it is a very strong piece. It's the strongest piece of criticism of the Goldstone report that we've seen, because it does deal with substance. It doesn't go after Goldstone personally, as so many others have. We have several responses to Halbertal. I think the strongest is Jerry Slater, a historian and a longtime observer of the conflict, who says that Israel had recourse to many measures before it dropped bombs on civilian neighborhoods. It had, yes, there was a real threat to its civilians from arms of Hamas and other terrorist outfits. Yes, no question. They were targeting civilian population in southern Israel. But Israel had several recourses before it launched an all-out assault on civilian infrastructure and indiscriminate attacks that killed over 300 children. And while Halbertal makes a legitimate point, he removes any sort of criticism of the way that Israel responded. And in fact, there were many things that Israel could do before it launched such an attack.
Well, what I think is interesting about that, particularly interesting, is Slater's article. You're looking at two issues. Goldstone talks about the methods of fighting the war, and that those are war crimes. But he really implicitly, and this is where Slater picks up Goldstone for it and is critical of Goldstone, he implicitly says that the war arguably was justified in self-defense. And Jerome Slater gives a very strong argument that there were two sorts of sets of war crimes here. One was making an aggressive war on Gaza, that there was no justification for the bombing, and the other is for the methods it used to fight that war. And it's very strong. And he ends the essay you put in here by saying that Goldstone mission actually understated the full range and import of Israeli criminality, and talks about the fact that this is an occupied area, and that the idea that it wasn't an aggressive war is really just wrong. And so Slater is really good on this, and I think it's a really important essay, Phil.
He says that because Gaza is blockaded, because it is occupied, because these people are under siege, international law has recognized the right of people to resist that. And Goldstone, of course, does not go there. But the answer is, if people are resisting occupation and siege, well, Israel has the ability to end that siege, to end that blockade. Those are the measures, those are the humane measures that Israel should have taken before this barbarity that it unleashed. And that's what Slater says.
We'll return with our discussion on the Goldstone Report after this break. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I just wanted to make one more point to your question, Michael, about the narrative of the conflict that the Goldstone Report contradicts what Israel tends to say. And this is the timeline aspect of the attack. Israel's narrative tends to be that they had been sustaining rocket fire from Gaza into southern Israel for years and had done everything they could to stop it. And this was the last thing that they were able to do to reword that. One of the things the Goldstone Report makes clear is that there had been a ceasefire in effect for up to 6 months before the Israeli attack that by all accounts had been working fine, and that Israel was the party to break that ceasefire in November of 2008.
Yes, I'm glad that you made that. It's a central point showing essentially the murderous expedition of the Israelis.
But that's not the only place where the report contradicts the Israeli narrative. And it's one of the points in the report that is considered most controversial, because the report goes out of its way not only to talk about Gaza. I mean, Israel often will talk about this conflict in Gaza as an exception to the general Israeli policy in the occupied territories, or even within Israel itself. And the Goldstone Report goes out of its way to talk about conditions in the West Bank, and to a certain degree even talk about conditions within Israel itself, to show, I mean, what the report says is connecting the dots. How was the Qassam-led invasion connected to the repression that's experienced towards Palestinians in the West Bank? How is it connected to the way that even Israeli dissent is cracked down on inside Israel? This is one of the points that the report has been most attacked for, but I think one of the points that's most powerful to show that Gaza wasn't an exception, but really a natural extension of the Israeli policy throughout historic Palestine.
We're interviewing Adam Horowitz, Lizzie Ratner, and Philip Weiss. They've written the excellent book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict.
You know, there's so many fine essays in here that are really, they're sharply worded, they're short. I learned a tremendous amount. And I want to take you to the one that comes after the Slater essay, and that's the one by former Congressman Brian Baird, who was, of course, a congressman up until January, and very strong position on Gaza. And what he does in this essay is something you almost never see out of a member of Congress. You see him discussing the vote that took place to condemn the Goldstone Report. The vote was some 300, you have the number in here, right? And he wrote it, it's whatever, some 300-something to 26, I think, to condemn the Goldstone Report. And what Brian Baird talks about in his essay is, what were members of Congress thinking or doing in this? And why don't one of you just address that? Because you almost never read a congressman talking about what other congressmen were thinking and doing. And he talks about what they were saying to him about the Goldstone Report.
The one thing that I found shocking about that, it is a great essay because it's so candid about how Congress works, is he had been to Gaza a couple of times at that point, several times when that report was issued. And he went around to other congressmen and said, do you want to hear what it was like? Don't you want to hear what I saw there? I read this report. This captures what I saw. And the leadership didn't want to hear from him. He discloses in this piece, too, that he would go to people and say, well, you know, it's a collective punishment. And they would, friends of his in Congress and even leadership positions would say, yeah, well, we know it's collective punishment. He said, but that's a war crime. And some of them didn't even know that that's a war crime.
That was a moment in the essay that I found absolutely shocking. And I think another sort of really revealing element of the essay is the way in which so many U.S. congresspeople are mapping the United States' own incredibly warped position vis-a-vis countries like Iraq and Afghanistan onto the situation in Israel. And so you have people in Congress, and here's just a quote, telling Brian Baird, well, you know, Gaza is Hamasistan. And so therefore, I guess by implication, it's okay for Israel to bomb it to smithereens, just as the United States has gone and bombed Iraq and Afghanistan to smithereens because we're going after so-called terrorists there. And so I think it's a really revealing moment where we can see how the United States is mapping the paradigm, the really troubling paradigm that we're using vis-a-vis terrorists in other countries. You know, we're saying it's okay for us to just go after countries, bomb them to pieces just because there are people there who don't like us and, you know, say they want to attack us, and in one case did attack us.
Baird says on that, he said he told members of Congress this, and they didn't understand that collective punishment is a war crime.
Right. So that, so first of all, that's collective punishment, and that is a violation of the Geneva Conventions and therefore a war crime. But I think, I guess what I'm trying to say here is this really kind of shows the proxy relationship, client relationship, close special relationship that exists between the United States and Israel, where we sort of see our situation mirrored in them, and they see their situation mirrored in us. And so we're okay to, we're happy to say, you know what, Israel, we're not going to stop you. We're not going to stop you when you go and inflict collective punishment on a captive population of 1.5 million people. Because if we stop you, then maybe we'll have to stop us when we go and try to bomb a country because there are elements in that country which don't like us, which say they want to attack us and in one case did attack us. And so to me, that was a really disturbing moment and a revealing moment where we just saw this special relationship kind of unpacked and we saw the way it's playing out here in this country. And Barrett essay is fundamentally about the United States, a condemnation vote by Congress, a vote in Congress to condemn the Goldstone Report. Now you say, why does Congress care about this? I mean, we have real issues. We have, at the time, we had major economic collapse. We had wars in Afghanistan. We had wars in Iraq. And Congress people are taking their time to vote on this report that came out in the United Nations about another country. And I think the reason is, one, we have a very close relationship with Israel. They are, you know, our chief recipient of military aid.
I thought they were our aircraft carrier in the Middle East.
Exactly. And but, you know, I think the other reason is the United States is scared that a report like this will someday, you know, be leveled against them. And the United States will have to say, wait a minute, you mean we can't just go and bomb civilians in other, or bomb other countries indiscriminately, even if civilians get killed? We can't just go and drop cluster bombs on another country.
I'd just like to add something that kind of gets back also to the question of why we even put this book together. In addition to the report, the attack on Gaza, one of the things that this book does is really help give a window into the current perception of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a whole and how that perception is changing. One of the things that's really powerful about Baird's piece is he talks about his own path and how he came to look at this conflict differently, much of which was really based on his on-the-ground experience. And he doesn't talk about it so much in his piece, but that vote in Congress is still talked about, not so much for how the vote ended up, but the speeches that were given on the floor of the House, one by Baird and by some other members, Earl Blumenauer is another, Lois Capps is another, were incredibly passionate pleas for not only supporting the Goldstone Report, but for acknowledging what happened in Gaza. And if you have a chance, many of them are, you can watch them on YouTube, you should go watch that, because the anti-Goldstone speeches were very uninformed about Gaza, about the report, very paint by the numbers. And here there was at least a dozen members of Congress getting up and pleading with their colleagues to support this report. And many people point to that moment as just another indication of how a tide is shifting. It might be shifting slowly, but it is shifting.
And I think another essay that brings that out here is Rashid Khalidi's piece.
Right.
Khalidi says the Goldstone Report could not have been written and would have had little effect as recently as a decade ago.
And the Ali Abanima piece says that too. He says the report marks a dramatic acceleration in the loss of this support.
You know, I was just going to point to the Abanima piece as well as one of the pieces that points to that shift. And his chapter goes on to discuss, which a point that Naomi Klein ends with, that in lieu of the UN or governments to hold Israel accountable, that it's left to the people to do that. She points to Argentina as a place where that example has been used. The Abanima chapter talks about that although the Goldstone Report has been dismissed by the U.S. government, that people in the United States, individuals and people around the world have used the Goldstone Report as a catalyst to build a growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions as a way to hold Israel accountable when the international community won't. And that movement, as much as people might want to try to dismiss this report, that movement is growing, and the war in Gaza and the Goldstone Report was a strong catalyst for that.
I mean, you have a piece in here by someone I wasn't sure I would expect to have in here, Letty Cotton Pogrebin. What is that piece about? I'm glad she's in here. I think she's an important figure, certainly in the American Jewish community.
You know, I think the piece serves a couple of different functions. One of the reasons we were so eager to have Letty contribute is that she's really allied with the liberal Zionist sort of parts of the Jewish spectrum. This is a part of the Jewish spectrum that hasn't necessarily been willing to come out and say what happened in Gaza was really wrong or what happened in Gaza has made us question our views about Israel. Letty's essay is called The Unholy Assault on Richard Goldstone, and it's really about the vitriolic, bilious campaign that was leveled against Goldstone by members of the established, organized Jewish community, the people, she says, who are unelected and yet consider themselves the leaders and spokespeople for the Jewish community. And these are people who, in the wake of the publication of the report, pretty much embarked on a witch hunt against Richard Goldstone. You know, they treated him like a witch and excommunicated him from the Jewish community. And this is a man who really was, as I said, very much tied to the Jewish community and considers himself a Zionist and a proud Jew. And Letty's thesis is basically that this effort to discredit Goldstone was really an effort to discredit the report. And because the people who were criticizing Goldstone couldn't necessarily make really strong criticisms of the report, they were instead just going after Goldstone. So it was sort of discredit Goldstone in order to discredit the report. And so her essay is about the various different ways in which these efforts to discredit Goldstone were undertaken or attempted.
We started by talking about there being some testimony in the book from the people who actually suffered in Gaza, and that Goldstone went and got some of that testimony in Geneva because the Israelis wouldn't let him in. Wouldn't let him into Israel to get any of that testimony, so he had to fly the people to Geneva. Is there a section you'd like to read us of a paragraph or two of that testimony? Because I think it's so compelling. And the other thing I think, Phil or Adam, while Lizzie's looking for what she wants to read, you guys did set up a website where, and you could just tell us what's on the website. It's www.goldstonereportbook.com, goldstonereportbook.com. We're talking to Adam Horwitz, Lizzie Ratner, and Philip Weiss, the editors of this new amazing nation book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. The introduction is by Naomi Klein. The foreword is by Desmond Tutu. 11 extraordinary essays, as well as large excerpts of the report. Very important book coming 2 years after the Gaza cast-led operation.
Can I set the stage for a quick second?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So, as you said, Goldstone held these hearings, and he really modeled them on truth and reconciliation hearings because he believed that victims rarely get their day in court. They rarely get to describe what happened to them. Governments do. They have PR machines. Victims don't. And so this was an opportunity to give victims on both sides an opportunity to say what had happened to them. And so I'm going to read a little bit from the testimony of a man named Khaled Abed Rabo, and he is a father, or was a father, of three young girls. On January 7th, 2009, he was in his house in the Izbat Abed Rabo, the Abed Rabo neighborhood of Gaza, with his wife and his mother and his three young girls, who span the ages of 2 to 7. The Israeli army came and bulldozed their garden, and there were tanks in front of their house, so they decided to evacuate their house, and they decided to do that with white flags. And so they began to leave their house, the young girls, the grandmother, they were carrying white flags, and they saw a tank a number of meters in front of their house, and they saw soldiers in the tank. And all of a sudden, a soldier comes out from behind the tank, and according to this testimony, just begins shooting at them, and he shoots directly at these young girls. Again, their ages 2 to 8. And he hits the girls. Two of them are killed, the 2-year-old and the 8-year-old. And the 4-year-old is critically, critically wounded. And last I knew, she was in a hospital in France where she was recovering, but she was paralyzed. This is his description after his daughters are shot. "My daughter, Amal, 3 years old, she was dying. And at the end of the day, she did die. My other daughter, 8 years old, like I said, her chest was riddled with bullets. She passed away. My other daughter, Samar, her back was riddled with bullets. Her back was open. She was not breathing through her nose, but through her lungs. And she was telling me, 'Dad, help, help.' And I couldn't do anything. She was thirsty. I was afraid if I gave her any water, something would happen. I didn't know what to do. My mother, 60 years old, was also dying. I was helpless. I didn't know what to do for my children. There was my daughter dying in front of me. So I carried her and left the house, even if I had to die myself because I couldn't take it anymore. So I carried my daughter and left the house again so that the soldier, he might just as well kill my daughter and kill me myself because I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't let my children die in front of me.
Well, thank you. I know you can get more of that, sadly, on your website.
Lizzie, Adam, Phil, you're a second generation after Michael and Heidi and me. It's hard to even articulate how gratifying it is for us to see the torch being passed to you. And I wanted to ask you, just on a personal basis, you know, there's a whole prophetic tradition in Jewry with prophets like Isaiah beat your swords into plowshares. And it seems to me that the work you've done on getting the Goldstone Report out is part of that tradition. Question to all three of you is, what was it in your lives that you didn't start out as people who wanted to tell the truth about what the Palestinians have suffered under Israeli occupation, but you've done it, and you've done it in a way that's really a credit to everybody that tries for justice in the world. And I wanted to ask you what it was personally that got you from where you started out to where you are now with the publication of this just marvelous book.
The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict.
You know, it's such a central question when you speak about Jews who are engaged in the question. For me, I would say that, like Goldstone himself, and though I had very little connection to Israel, I had a very positive view of Israel most of my life. I just sort of absorbed that from the Jewish community. And I knew I didn't really want to look at it too closely because I sensed that some stuff wasn't that great. But I certainly had a generally positive image of Israel. And when I finally went there in 2006, and I saw what was going on in Hebron, in occupied Hebron, a tour led by a very prophetic Jew, Yehuda Shaul, of Breaking the Silence. It's just crushing to this day to remember what we saw that day. And I couldn't understand Hebrew. He was speaking in Hebrew, but the criminality, the complete selfishness, the utter just indifference to other people's lives. And that began to open my eyes, and I think that one of the key things that Lizzie said about this report is that Goldstone himself was afraid to go into Gaza. And I think the really crushing part of this experience for me, this awakening, has been that I realized how much I was made to hate Arab people and Palestinian people and to think that they were lesser. And Goldstone's fear of going into Gaza is a piece of that. And my own fears about going to Gaza was a piece of that. And then you go there and you meet these people and you realize that they are incredibly dignified, civilized people. Everything you've heard is wrong. And about them, there's just the racism that exists in our community toward these people is just so profound. And I feel like that is, you know, we talk about the failure of this report to gain traction in international legal circles or where it should, at The Hague. Yeah, it's not moving ahead, but where it is moving ahead is in this drip, drip, drip that Ali Abu Nima talks about, that Rashid Khalidi talks about, and that Letty is talking about. It's the kind of growing awareness inside the Jewish community, because Rashid and Ali both refer to those kind of liberal, progressive circles from which Israel has drawn its support traditionally, and I think if it's an empowered community, the Jewish community is beginning to accept that there has been a culture of impunity here that has to change, and that culture of impunity derives from a spiritual disregard for these human beings as human beings. And that is a process that Goldstone has advanced immeasurably, and that our report is part of that process.
I want to build off of what Phil said, because in a lot of ways my personal story is very similar. It, growing up in the Jewish community in a very conservative political atmosphere, and then finding later, when I had an opportunity to actually go visit on the ground, to learn that basically everything I had been told, not an outright lie, had it was very much one part of the story. And I don't feel, I mean, the question was sort of framed as sort of a Jewish response. Although I was raised and I am Jewish, I don't see my response as being Jewish in particular. I've met a lot of other people from all different faiths and backgrounds who have had a very similar response, especially people from the U.S., because whether you're in the Jewish community or not, we're all sort of inundated with these same messages through the media here in the U.S., who then go over and see the conditions on the ground, are just shocked and amazed. Building off the short excerpt that Lizzie wrote, one of the things, if you know, someone was to ask me why should I sit down and read a UN report, which on the face of it sounds like it could be sort of a tedious exercise. I mean, at the heart of it, the Goldstone Report tells the story of people who had to live through a horribly traumatic event. And in reading those stories, like the one that Lizzie shared and like many other, it performs much of the same function that Phil just described that you have when you see on the ground. It humanizes a people, the people of Gaza, that whether you're conscious of it or not, are constantly vilified in the political discourse in the United States, in the popular discourse in movies and television. And this book and the Goldstone Report really, in some ways for the first time in the broad discourse, turns that on its head and shows that the people who are being attacked here are people just like you and I, like our families, and having to watch their loved ones be killed before their eyes. You might not come out agreeing with everything in the book, but you won't be able to just dismiss 1,300 people being killed as people that should have died.
I have a similar story, and yet it's a variation on the theme. I chose to go to Israel in the mid-90s, and I felt sort of called to go there, for lack of a better way to put it, and also felt kind of in a vague, amorphous way that we should all be behind peace, right? Because who believes in violence? And let's just all get along. And it was a moment of transformation in Israel. It was sort of the end of the Oslo era. It was when Rabin was assassinated. It was a time of turmoil. And so you couldn't really be there, I don't think, as a thinking, questioning person without beginning to think and without beginning to question. And I should say I was really attracted to the place. You know, I have to be really nakedly honest here. There was something seductive and appealing about it to me when I was there. And at the same time, as I began, after Rabin was assassinated, I was at the rally and you saw this vitriol and hatred and began hearing things about people in these occupied territories just a few meters away. I realized I had to go and see for myself what was going on. And so wandered one day into the Alternative Information Center and they said, okay, if you want to understand what's going on, grab a taxi at the Damascus Gate and go to Bethlehem tomorrow and you'll meet a man named Ziad who will tell you about the situation among Palestinian political prisoners, and we need that for some reports that we're doing. And so I took a taxi, I grabbed my passport, went to the Damascus Gate, and in a matter of 15 minutes, went on this world-changing, world-shattering journey that took me from the glossy first world affluence, really, of Jerusalem into past a checkpoint, an armed military checkpoint, into a world where people, where stores were closed because there was a closure, you know, allegedly to protect Israel from so-called terrorists and things like that. But people, you know, stores were closed. They were closed. There was no food. The streets were dusty. There was poverty. And you couldn't. And all of a sudden I said, wait a minute. Is this, you know, what I've been taught to fear? Is this what I've been taught is the great enemy? Are these people here the great enemy? And sort of in a matter of moments, my whole understanding of the situation shifted and my world kind of shattered because, you know, I grew up here in the United States hearing, you know, a narrative, a meme maybe, but that Jews played a role in the civil rights movement. Jews have a role in progressive causes and that there was this thing called the Holocaust. And as a result of it, you kind of have to fight against oppression and repression and racism. And all of a sudden, I was seeing oppression and repression and a degree of racism and racism playing out in front of me. It horrified me and broke my heart. And so that was this transformative moment. And I'm embarrassed to say that I was engaged in the issue for a number of years. And then I came back to the United States and really got engaged in things here. And I was inactive. I was passive. I was apathetic for many, many years. And then Gaza happened 2 years ago. I saw this rain of bombs and phosphorus and starvation. And it kind of yanked me out of the comfort zone that I'd created for myself. And as a final point, I'll say we knew somebody in our family, a family friend who is Gazan, And in a sort of well-known story, he's a doctor, and his three daughters were killed, three young daughters, on the second to last day of Operation Cast Lead. I had talked to him at the height of the conflict, or the height of the war, and he had told me about being in his house and the windows shaking and their water supply dwindling and the terror of his young children, and I could hear the panic in his voice. And it was sort of at that moment that I said, I don't want to be apathetic anymore. I would like to reengage, and I need to reengage. This is an issue that people engage in for all kinds of reasons. And for me, it's because as someone who believes staunchly in human rights and somebody who believes that you just don't go and kill people and occupy them, and I'm just sort of personally offended and morally offended as a human. But for me also, there is a Jewish component in that I feel like I'm implicated in this. Israel does this often in the names of Jews, or in the name of all Jews or many Jews. And so I feel like I have a role to play and to say, well, not in my name. And there is this prophetic tradition, and I'm a little bit loath to kind of put myself or any of us in it here, but nonetheless, there's a prophetic tradition of Jews going out there and saying, stop it, Jews, Jewish people, you're doing the wrong thing. You're behaving in a way that's evil, that's amoral, that's unethical, that's wrong, and stop. You know, Goldstone was called a traitor for what he did, an anti-Semite, a self-hater. Alan Dershowitz called him a Moser, which is, again, a sort of traitor, but comes with very other implications. Anyway, people who will point the finger at Goldstone or any of us here as Jews who've participated in this and say you're a self-hater and you're a traitor. In fact, there's a tradition of Jews coming out and saying, no, you cannot do things that are wrong and that are evil and that are against your tradition and your religion. So that's an important point I want to make, but also then just say that, so I speak from this Jewish perspective, but also as, you know, from an American perspective and just kind of a human perspective, because let's face it, any human should be offended by what happened in Gaza and what still happens there.
Well, the three of you, thank you first for those really moving statements about your own journey, as well as really for the hard work of putting together this important book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict.
Adam Horwitz, Lizzie Ratner, Phil Weiss, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for the book.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.